Hi, everyone. It's April 30th, and here we are on the last day. Oh my gosh, I don't know where this month has gone. Has it been as busy for you? But I have a plan. I always have a plan, or at least the plan reveals itself as I step one big step beyond it. And that is, I've had several series in mind because I'm really enjoying taking a deeper dive with you all into particular topics that are of interest to me and hopefully to you as well. Taking a deeper dive into those, and I was wrestling this month with which one to flow next into, and I've decided on today's topic, which is the shadow functions of the personality. And that's where we're going to go today. And because this is the last day of April, obviously we'll have three installments in May so that we're caught up to post per month rhythm. But I'm happy with how this is fleshing out because I have other ideas in mind, but they weren't quite ready. So we're going with this one. So I hope this will be really interesting and fun for you and timely. That, again, is sort of what I keep returning to in my own path is if it's not flowing, then this isn't the moment, you know? So I just waited. And then the month, April itself, was particularly busy for me. We had spring break. My daughter and I snuck away for a few days. And then there have been all the spring festivities, and prom was yesterday, and there's just been so much going on that I've had a lot going on in my mind in terms of preparation and certainly in terms of personal growth, lots happening there. But getting in front of the mic has eluded me until now, but I wanted to get this note out to you all that we're on track, and I'm going to lay the foundations today for this little mini series we're doing on the shadow functions of the personality, and then we'll flesh that out in May. So I hope you're all doing really well, and wherever you find yourself, that there's some beautiful color unfolding one way or the other. In many places, it's really leaning into spring right now, and that's certainly lovely and welcome. And the full moon, which is in the flower moon phase, will actually be May 5th. So that's coming right up. So we're in the waxing stages toward that. And I'd love to share a waxing moon poem that I wrote regarding the flower moon. And it goes like this: "And the color silver, mercurial, glinting, sleek and quick moving, like the shifting inner landscape, passing under moon and cloud cover, refracting, the new change, the full change, the change of sovereign space, where the mighty holds the discerning sword, no longer in reflexive attack or puny defense, but now in honor of her, in honor of him, in honor of what now is." Once again, I marvel. When I wrote that, it had meaning to me, obviously, but now reading it with all of our transurfing material and realizations and deepening into that mystery, this means so much more to me because swords symbolically are often linked to thought and thought patterns. And I love this idea in this poem, which is newly revealing itself even to me, and I'm the one that wrote it, which tells you, you know, that the universe is speaking to us always. But I love this idea of the sword being used very skillfully, not to attack or defend the indefensible or, you know, defend our weaknesses. You've heard that phrase, you know, sort of arguing for your weaknesses until you stop doing that. I've certainly done that. But increasingly, I am catching myself. I hope you're feeling this too. The exuberance, and I use that word intentionally, of like, oh my God, I'm catching myself. I'm not falling into these old patterns like I used to, those old patterns of the mind that just keep repeating history. I love that. It's so empowering to me. And life is getting simpler in my experience in terms of all the stuff going on in my head. It just, very few ideas are worth sitting with. The rest can be acknowledged aloud and then just set aside, you know, so as to decrease their importance. It's so fantastic to have that skill set and to see it flowering here in the flower moon. And I love this idea, again, of using the sword, using the thought so, so skillfully now. And that's so liberating. And remember that if you approach life from an archetypal perspective, the masculine and the feminine exist within us all. So it's silly to attack them externally either way, because although there may be examples or momentary materializations of quote unquote negative aspects of the masculine and feminine in the external space, okay, it is what it is. We live in a culture where there's a lot going on. We have our own histories with the masculine and the feminine, but I just encourage us all to remember that their most beautiful versions, both of them, and then beyond gender, just all reside within us from the archetypal depth psychological perspective, and to engage the mature masculine, the mature feminine, and their beautiful union together that is greater than any gender concept is so empowering and so fruitful and so home, so the essence of home. Because whatever you were presented with parental figures, it doesn't matter at the end of the day. Past relationships, it doesn't matter. You have home, this beautiful inner marriage of these incredible forces within you. And when you tend to that marriage, whatever partnership in the external space that is enlivened by these energies becoming greater than the sum of their parts is blessed, whether that's a human partnership or a creative partnership or a business partnership or all of the above. The inner marriage, tending to that, just absolutely releases the outer marriage to step forward, to mirror itself. And I feel like this poem is speaking to that. And maybe I had a glimmer of that when I wrote it, but now I'm experiencing that more and more. So I'm deeply grateful. And I hope you're doing well. I hope that April is a rewarding time for you and challenging in the way that you're seeing your growth happen and experiencing increasingly more your authentic self. And I just want to make another note here that if you visit my website at lauriegreen.net, I have this beautiful collection that I released for the month of April and May, and it's called Metamorphosis. And it's under 20 items, but my purpose on the website is to curate beautiful seasonal reflections of soul for the home and for your creative space. And they all coordinate, they all mix and match. There's some beautiful art there. I've been able to partner with a really cool art house in Europe and offer their pieces on my site. And then I have some of my own patterns that mix and match for items in the home, like to set a lovely table and just honoring that seasonal soulful rhythm. And this collection, the Metamorphosis collection, is only available until the end of May. So check that out, because there's some beautiful, beautiful pieces that I find so inspiring. And it's nice to have that seasonal anchor in your home, just being in step with the unfolding of the natural world. And a new collection will go up in June. So it's just there for a while. Take a look at that. I redesigned the website a little bit, so it's super easy to navigate. And obviously you can find the podcast there. But if you're listening to this, you've already found the podcast, but you can share it with others. They can go right to the website, whatever, to find all that I'm offering there. But that creative aspect of what I do has become so important to me. It's such a joy for me. So the podcast is how I connect with you all. You know, I certainly do some individual consultation and workshops, which is another treasured aspect of what I do. But this creative piece is really my heart out in the world, just being happy and courting like-minded folks who just love soul and aren't about trends and, you know, the crazy pace of social media, but just like those beautiful reflections of home and self and soul and, you know, love creating a sense of place. So check that out. And today, what we're going to do is I'm going to share an article that I will link to in the show notes. And I chose this one because it had a really good layman's perspective, layman language about the shadow functions of the personality. And it's from psychologyjunkie.com, and it's written by Susan Storm. I will, again, link this. I'm not going to read it word for word because it's obviously her work, but I love the way she flows through this, and she quotes people that I know and have a lovely working relationship with. And I'll just give you a little bit of background about this, but we're just going to lay some foundational work here. And then in the next three mini series, I'll be sharing articles that I wrote around personality that have been published. And we'll dive in because they're sort of all of a piece, and they're all actually very propitiously talking about the inner marriage and the psychological inner marriage. And so it seems like the appropriate time to dive into that, because all of the work that we do, all of the exploration that we do in this podcast, whether it's looking at Peter Kingsley's work or C.G. Jung's work or Vadim Zeland's work, they're all ways of becoming psychologically integrated and expressing that wholeness and experiencing that wholeness. And I'm revisiting these articles and this topic of the shadow functions because it's so helpful in assisting that work and seeing what might be going on in your life. But that, in my estimation, is the greater aim that all of this exploration is serving. And so I just wanted to begin there, because it's been enormously helpful to me in my life. I've been a part of this work since grad school. I became introduced to it in grad school, but it continues to deepen and develop. So a little bit of background on what I mean by personality and then the shadow functions. You're probably all aware of the Myers-Briggs type indicator, you know, and that's where you have four letters that constitute your preferences for how your personality expresses itself. And it's not to put people into boxes, because every human is wildly unique, but it's helpful to understand sort of what default positions people fall to and how in interacting with others, those positions can harmonize or collide. And then most importantly, how those positions with our conscious and unconscious aspects of personality are harmonizing or colliding within ourselves. That's where I really get excited about this work. Yes, it's enormously helpful externally with folks, but it's even revolutionary if you apply it to the self. So C.G. Jung, just over 100 years ago, released his work, Psychological Types. And that laid the foundation for what Myers and Briggs did later, and then it's evolved and expanded again with the work of John Beebe. And John Beebe did a really fascinating and enormously contributed, in my estimation, to the field of this work by bringing in depth psychology to psychological type. And in doing so, he talked not only about what was going on in the conscious aspect of your typology, but unconsciously what's going on and how that links up archetypally to aspects of ourselves. And that's what the article I'm going to share with you talks about. And so I had an introduction to all this work in grad school, and my professor, her name is Carol Shoemate. She's fantastic. We are friends to this day. And after grad school, she invited me to be part of the editorial staff of their online journal, which is Personality Type In Depth. And that can be found at typeindepth.org. And I remain part of the editorial staff, although I've migrated more to the podcast now. And I love doing that because, you know, everybody finds their place where they really shine. And to me, that's where I can offer the most value right now. But I have certainly worked with people on articles and visions for articles. I've enjoyed that part. There are other folks that do, you know, a great job with the scholarly aspect and having it present really in the scholarly fashion that have that as their strength. Carol Shoemate and Mark Hunziker are the creators of this online journal, and they are both published in the field. They're excellent resources. They both collaborate with John Beebe. It's just a wealth of scholarly sophistication and knowledge around this topic. Jenny Soper is an amazing editor who is deeply schooled in all of this as well. I know she uses type in her day job with students at Wake Forest. Olivia Ireland is an artist, and she does a lot of our graphic support and vision. Erin Temple is an amazing editor on the staff. There's just an excellent group of people that collaborate and put this journal out. And then, of course, our amazing writers. I have contributed articles to this. Those are the ones I'll be sharing with you. But I'm so much richer for having participated and learned from these people. And I feel extremely fortunate to be in their company, to continue to learn from them. And they have helped me so much in my own understanding. So humbly, very humbly, I bring this to our podcast. If you want to check out the Personality Type In Depth podcast, I do that as well. You'll hear my voice on other people's articles. So it's just a verbatim audio recording, but that's also a way to connect with this work. And I continue to work on our backlog of articles as I have time. So there's all kinds of ways to get involved in this material. But back to the article that I want to lay some foundational work today. A lot of this you'll probably be familiar with, but it'll be a good refresher, is this Susan Storm sort of summation of the shadow functions. And I'll just read a bit and then just discuss, kind of like we've done in the past, using it as a skeleton, but then elaborating. And you'll hear the folks I've talked about referenced today. They're quoted in the article. And we'll lay the foundation today and then dive into these articles, you know, three of them in the month of May. But just as by way of just a bit of a refresher, the four letters that you have for your Myers-Briggs, and you can take these, you know, surveys online. And although that isn't, you know, the best way to do it, because somebody who's well-schooled in type can really help bring out the nuance and help you accurately decide what you prefer or how you default. Again, not to keep you in a box, but to help you accurately assess how you like to present the personality in the world. You can sort of get a ballpark. There's all kinds of tests to take online to do that. And then, you know, hopefully the work that we are doing here will help you further define that. And then you can reach out to people that are actually certified in this to fine tune and come into real resonance if that's of interest to you. But broadly speaking, and this comes from C.G. Jung's work, the first letter represents if you're an introvert or an extrovert. And again, speaking in very broad terms here, where do you get your energy? Do you get your energy by spending time alone and sort of connecting with your inner life, or externally with others, with the object, with out there? How do you recharge? Okay. And, you know, everybody's a combination of all these things. There's no purist in any way, but definitely I'm an introvert. To recharge, I need to be with me. And my husband definitely recharges by being around other people. I mean, that's just as clear as day to me. So that's your first letter. The second one is how you take in information. And that's through the senses or through your intuition. And again, we're all a combination of those, but you'll default to one or the other. And again, there's that sensory experience of how things sound, taste, look, feel, etc. Sensory sort of objective information, or that intuitive leap. Okay. The third is how you make your decisions, how you choose a direction once you've processed that information. Do you do it by thinking or feeling? And feeling is important to note that this is not a wishy-washy, oh, I'm just going on a feeling. It is considered a rational function, okay? It is not considered in the common vernacular about, you know, it has been devalued. Oh, it's just a feeling. No, it's considered in typology to have just as much weight, if you will, as thinking. It's just your value system. Are you valuing the mental arguments for something, or are you valuing a moral position? And they're both considered rational. Because again, there's sort of a pejorative that, oh, you base something on a feeling, and that can be sort of indicating, oh, you were just emotional about that. That is not what the feeling function is about. The feeling function is taking the information and then making a moral decision about something, as opposed to or in a higher position than a logical one, a rational one. So again, we all do both. But by way of example, let's say there's a tragedy in the family and you are asked to take a child into your home that no longer has parents. Okay, you could make logical reasons why that may or may not be suited to your life. And then you can make moral reasons. And those might be very different outcomes depending on how your personality orients itself. So that could be an example of how the decision would ultimately be made. And again, neither is right nor wrong. And they both offer a balance to the other. But it's how decisions get made. And then that last letter is a J or a P, and it stands for originally judging or perceiving, which are kind of difficult terms, I think, sometimes to understand. But what it means is, like, basically, do you value process or do you need order? Okay. And if you kind of like things tidy, or if you're just totally fine with things totally being in process and chaos is not as disturbing to you, that indicates your last letter. So there are 16 combinations of all of these letters to create the personality types. And we're talking about thinking and feeling, extroversion and introversion, intuition, sensation, perceiving and judging. We're thinking about all of those aspects. But as you look at a chart of how that proceeds for each of those 16 personalities, then there's what's going on in the unconscious, which is usually a mirror, the reverse of those functions, and how that might be either assisting or undermining what's going on in your own personality. And that's where Beebe, John Beebe, has greatly contributed to this field. And then Carol Shoemate and Mark Hunziker, et cetera, the folks on the team at Personality Type and Depth, have really created beautiful careers and published excellent work out of that work as well. And it is fascinating. So I want to just jump into this article and highlight some things. You can spend some time with the article between now and when we start in on our examples in this little mini series on shadow types and shadow functions in the personality. But let's just hop right in with Susan Storm's article here, The Shadow Functions. If you really want to dive deep into the more complex and rarely discussed aspects of personality type, then delving into the shadow functions can be a lot of fun and very helpful. So she talks right away about the dichotomies that I've just mentioned that you're probably aware of. And then I'm going to list the cognitive functions, because this will be referenced throughout everything I'm doing in this mini series. So FI and FE, TI and TE, SI and SE, NI and NE. All that means is, for example, FI, FE, that's the feeling function, whether it's expressing itself in introversion or extroversion, okay? T, the thinking function, introversion or extroversion, because depending on where the energy flow is going with that particular cognitive function, it behaves differently in the personality. SI, SE, the sensation, the sensing function, introverted or extroverted, and then intuition is N, introverted or extroverted. So again, you have these cognitive functions. All of them exist in all of us. We just default and preference them. And I'll put a note in here too, at different times in our lives too, because your personality structure exists very early on. Like, for example, Carol Shoemate, when she was teaching us how to spot personality type in people, she would use examples on YouTube of people. And to see somebody, you know, in the around the age of 18, you really see their default personality type loud and clear. And so she would often use examples of people in roughly that age group, because it's super pronounced then. As you mature and become more adult, you nuance that. And then an amazing thing happens around midlife. You start really caring about all of the functions that have been in the subconscious or the unconscious, because it so lends a wholeness and a beauty of expression to a whole life, where you're not just defaulting to the preferred ones. You're experiencing what's called the ego dystonic ones, the ones in the subconscious, and it's adding a depth and a nuance to your whole experience. It's essential that we move into those unexplored areas of our personality. And of course, it comes as no surprise that you're probably attracted to people in friendships who are a lot like you, and in partnerships to people that probably represent what's going on in your unconscious. That totally makes sense, doesn't it? And it's just like awesome in the beginning, and then you get to deal with it. Yeah, so that's fun, but very empowering if we can frame it in a more productive way. So four functions will be in your consciousness, and then four that will be in your unconscious. And so you'll have your dominant function, that's your lead function, okay? And I'll flesh this out here in a minute. Right underneath that would be your auxiliary. It's a great helper. It's sort of the second in command. Your tertiary is your third function, and it's usually a skill set that helps you start to access the ones that are more in the unconscious. And then your inferior function occupies the fourth position, and it has a lot of nuance to it too. So I'll just get to that in a second, but I wanted to give you those four terms: your dominant, your auxiliary, your tertiary, and your inferior. There's so much power in the inferior function, and we're going to dive into all that. There's great quotes from Marie-Louise von Franz and Jung about that. I mean, that is a powerhouse of information. But let me, for example, I orient to an INFJ personality structure. And so my lead function is introverted intuition, which would be NI. And then my second in command is extroverted feeling. My third is introverted thinking. And my fourth is extroverted sensation. And it's helpful when you pull up these graphs, which is easy to do on the internet. You could just type in like the personality chart for the cognitive functions. You could do a search on that and easily find what yours is. You might flag the BB chart and you could easily access what yours is. It'll have both the conscious and the unconscious chart of that. So you could see and sort of start to understand how it works together. And you'll see that, for example, in mine, in the conscious part of my chart, NI is my main function, my primary. And so in the shadow, the opposite of that, extroverted intuition, or NE, would be my first function in the subconscious that would oppose it. You know, so it's the opposite. You have the introverted intuition, extroverted intuition would be its mirror in the shadow. My second lead is extroverted feeling. So obviously the second one in my shadow function would be introverted feeling. So you see how that works. You get the mirror of those with the opposite extroverted or introverted orientation. So then my third one in the conscious is introverted thinking. So obviously the third one in my unconscious is extroverted thinking. My fourth one in the conscious is extroverted sensation. So you got it. My last, deepest buried in the unconscious is introverted sensation. So they mirror each other. And there's so much to be gained from that. And then what John Beebe's work does is assign archetypal roles to all eight of those positions. So the four in the conscious and the four in the unconscious. And let me just touch on those right now. We'll hear it in the article from Susan Storm, but just so that you have broadly these archetypal roles that they play. So your main function in the conscious is your hero function or your heroine. It's your lead one. The second position is often called the parental or the good parent, you know, like the helper. The third one is considered sort of your puer or puella or your childlike wonder quality, sort of your eternal enjoyment, the part of you that may or may not want to grow up, and there's a lot of potential there. And it's helpful helping you start to go into the unconscious ones. The fourth archetypal position is anima and animus. and it will be the opposite of whatever gender you are. I mean, they're both there. But archetypally speaking, as somebody who presents female, that position in my chart in terms of archetypal expression is going to be really wired with the animus. So the masculine energy of the animus. And of course, there's information to be gleaned from both aspects, because again, we all possess both, but there's a lot of juice in my animus, or that masculine energy, that's starting to go into the unconscious. But you see how interesting it becomes, because what cognitive function exists in my fourth position on my chart is different than it is for other people. So for example, it's extroverted sensing for me, which means that the sensory world initially was probably harder for me to navigate than somebody else as a child who had a different personality structure. And that's true. I was so largely in my imagination. You know, that was my lead dog. And so to have sensation, extroverted sensation, be my gateway basically to the unconscious, finding ways to express myself from the animus masculine perspective has been enormously challenging. And then, of course, you know, like my father happened to be a personality that led with that. And so, you know, like he was a person that was always, you know, running construction jobs and lining people out and that sort of extroverted sensory thinking. And so that was kind of foreign to me in my thinking. And I'm sure my way of thinking or being in the world was foreign to him. And so I've had to, over time, come into relationship with extroverted sensing as a gift. And something that's helped me do that enormously is like mindfulness and meditation practice, like being in nature and loving the senses as a gateway to that which is calm and inspirational. And that's really exciting to me. And that has freed up that position in my personality structure. That's just one example. But I've also had to also face some darker aspects or shadow aspects there that want to rear up and cause turmoil. And you'll see that when we go into the deeper dive with my articles, I talk about that. But just again, broadly, to kind of situate what these archetypal positions offer us. Now going into the unconscious, that first level in your unconscious, which would be the fifth position, you know, the first four being conscious and then 5, 6, 7, and 8 being totally in the unconscious. Number five would be your opposing personality. The next one down, which would be opposite, your good parent would be your witch or your Senex, meaning that critical nature. So whereas your good parent in the conscious, the helper, the dystonic one would be that which criticizes you and undermines you and sort of puts a brick on everything. Okay. The third position in the unconscious is the trickster, and that offsets the child in the conscious. And then the fourth is mostly buried in the unconscious, which is the eighth position overall, is the demonic. And that opposites your animus, inferior function. But the amazing thing about that last deepest position is the demonic can come, the daimonic. So the D-E-M-O-N-I-C can become the D-A-I-M-O-N, the daimon, which is the electrifying unity, the soul come alive and electrifying the entire spine of your personality and leading the way. It can be the absolute brilliance of your personality when accessed and when allowed to integrate. So none of these positions is, quote, all good or all bad. They squirrel around and behave differently. It's fascinating. It's interesting. You don't have to have a PhD in this to benefit from this. And I know I'm giving you a lot of technical information now. Just let it wash over you because I'm just laying the ground. By the time we've gone through several articles that reveal how these layers of personality work, you'll have a really good understanding of at least how the system operates. And then if you want to do your own work or look at the wealth of articles on our journal's site that are available, you can do that because there's fabulous, fabulous topics. Everything from Kurt Cobain to sex and madness to political discussion and discourse, all under the larger umbrella of type and depth psychology in our articles on the website. So it's fascinating stuff. So with that, let me continue on in this article by Susan Storm. Again, the shadow in broad terms is just the dark, the unlived, and the repressed side of the self. Yes, there is disturbance there. There are aspects of our psychology that throw sand in the gears, but there's also deliverance there, and there's also incredible gifts there. So, for example, things that you weren't allowed to do or express as a child that are still there, that are still wanting to be known. I mean, there's a wealth of gold in the shadow, and we often project it onto other people. When you fall in love, you are actually seeing your gold in your shadow on another person, and you've projected it onto them because you can handle it out there in another person. And obviously the task of individuation is to accept all that gold in yourself and then just let your partner or whoever you've fallen in love with just be a human being, because they can't hold all that godly position for anybody except themselves. So, you know, there's so many discussions and layers of discussion upon layers of discussion to have with this material. But anyway, trying to keep this simple here, C.G. Jung said, quote, "The unconscious is unfavorable or dangerous only because we are not at one with it and therefore in opposition to it." Okay, so our task is to get to learn and get to know it. And again, nothing is either good nor bad. It's more like known and unknown, and understanding how it works. And beautifully, we can take our discipline with the transurfing material about pendulums and being discerning in quote unquote positive and negative thoughts or experiences that show up, and decide whether we want to give them our attention or not in terms of letting it taking over our thinking. We can continue to use that skill set, that ever-developing skill set, with this material as well. And that will help create the positive rapport with the shadow. I will say one thing. I got all excited about this material in grad school, and of course, immediately post-grad school. And it was easy because I lead with intuition, and those are strengths of mine. It was easy to get a little glib about the shadow. And I just offer that as a cautionary tale to everybody. The shadow is not something to mess around with. And I don't mean that in a fear-based sense. It's just something to have great reverence for, and to proceed with humility, okay? There's nothing that with humility and your authentic self you can't handle, because, quote unquote, it's all God, it's all divine, psychologically speaking. But having said that, you know, I think it's easy to get a little pop psychology and just think, oh yeah, the shadow's awesome, and it can kick your ass, I'm here to tell you. So, you know, proceed with humility and knowing the power that it has to come at you in ways that can derail you. So don't be glib about it, and I speak that from experience. Let me give you a great quote here by Mark Hunziker, who I am blessed to work with on the journal. Quote, "When the tools available to our ego are not sufficient to defend us from assaults upon our personal integrity, the shadow usually steps in unconsciously with its alternative ways of operating, unfettered by moral constraints." That's such a great quote about how the shadow is balancing and throwing us off all at the same time. It's a very wily set of rules and no rules that it plays by. So it's really asking us to be supple and to be able to change perspective and use our discernment with our thinking so as to pinpoint whether we are actually conscious or experiencing something that's unconscious that's trying to pull the puppet strings, okay? We can usually feel that even if we can't quite discern it yet. John Beebe, the typologist who came up with the 8-function personality model, that's what his model is referred to, states that the shadow functions, quote, "fight dirty to defend the personality." He says, "The shadow is the part of us that others see, but we don't." That's fascinating. Okay, so once again, moving down through this article, which again is in great layman terms, that first function, the hero function, your dominant function, she says in this article, the superior function, the one that is most easy to develop and have conscious control of. And here's another quote from Mark Hunziker about the hero dominant function. If you notice that you or someone else has shifted into a leading the charge mode, as if carrying out a dramatic banner ahead of the troops with complete confidence in the rightness of action or position, and serious, therefore, that others will be compelled to follow, you've probably seen the energy signature of the hero or the heroine, okay? So that would be position number one in any of our personality charts. I'm going to jump now to function 4, and you'll see why here in just a second, which is your inferior function. So you have your hero and your heroine, and then your inferior, but again, these are all in your conscious chart, okay, in your conscious aspects, but your inferior one is your least developed one. So we're just going to talk about those two as juxtaposed to each other. Your inferior one, the anima or the animus, let me read to you a great quote from Marie-Louise von Franz, who was a student of Jung's, carried on his work. The anima is the least conscious ego function. It is the doorway to the unconscious. It feels like part of us, but it is the exact opposite of the hero, and therefore often suppressed. In most normal societies, people cover up their inferior function with a persona. One of the main reasons why one develops a persona is so as not to expose your inferiorities, especially the inferiorities of the fourth function. So that's why we're talking about that instead of hopping right into the second one. They really sort of offset each other. The inferior function is intrinsically linked to the dominant function. It is one of the last functions to become assimilated into the ego. And it's also one of our weakest functions. We often suppress this function or try to hide it because we know we can't wield it effectively most of the time. It is often a source of shame, and it may take a great deal of time before we feel comfortable using it consciously. We tend to admire people who use this function well, but personally, we often find using this function a waste of time. Healthy development of the dominant function relies on some healthy development of the inferior function. People who suppress the inferior function for most of their lives become one-sided, imbalanced, and unhealthy. Okay? And again, there's that animus aspect of it, which we will flesh out in the episodes ahead. Number 2, the function that is second in your conscious ego position is the mother-father or the auxiliary function, the good parent. This function supports your dominant function and nurtures and protects the individual and others. In me, that is extroverted feeling. And what that often translates to is that I am very honed in on external harmony. I can walk into a room and tell you who's upset, who's okay, who's tired, all the rest of it. And I immediately start seeking external harmony. And that is a blessing and a curse. It has greatly helped me in my life. It's a superpower for sure. But when others only view you as that, and when you only identify yourself as that, that can become really toxic really fast, because it's not my job to make external harmony. And I've carried that a lot in my life. And so that's an example straight away of the positive and negative aspects of it. And a lot of times folks come to rely on me to take care of the external harmony, and they don't like it when I don't, because then it's on them to do their own harmony. And my internal harmony, which would be in my second position in my unconscious chart, in the sixth position, if you're following along, is the Witch Senex archetype of internal harmony. So that's where I'm really critical of how my harmony is. So quick to judge myself about, oh, you think you deserve that? Oh, well, you really don't. That kind of thing. And so to prioritize my own sense of harmony, even if nobody else gets it, nobody else wants it, is my challenge and my gift to the unconscious traits, unconscious cognitive functions, to free that and to make that witch a positive figure, to turn her from being sort of a wicked witch that's undermining me, or the Saturn Senex figure as an advocate and a discerning, oh no, do not get in her way. She deserves to have inner harmony as well. Turning them into allies that hold a container and a space for my inner harmony to be a priority. And that actually helps the external harmony more than anything, because we're moving into that mirror function of resonance and people being inspired to have their own harmony, as opposed to me trying to go out there and fix things. So it's a skill. It's a skill that has served me. It is not a skill I should rely on my whole life at the expense of internal harmony. Okay, let me continue on. Here's a great quote by Mark Hunziker about this good parent or father-mother auxiliary position. Our best leaders manifest this role towards those in their charge, shielding them from non-productive criticism and pressures, keeping them from taking unnecessary risks, and providing the information and tools that enable them to succeed. So it's awesome until it's not. Okay, the third archetypal position, called the Eternal Child in my, the INFJ chart, this is internal thinking, or TI. And that means, you know, I can take material and really enjoy learning from it. And that's evident, I think, in the fact that I try to do a lot of scholarly stuff here on the podcast, a lot of information that makes us think differently. Like, I find joy in that. Grad school was a tremendous joy, that although it's not my dominant function and I really had to apply myself, there's a joy in it for me. And I love learning. And that helps me start accessing. Learning helps me access those unconscious functions. And look at the learning I chose, depth psychology. I mean, it totally lines up with my personality that I would lead with intuition and have a tertiary function of, hey, why don't we go learn about this stuff, freeing me to myself. Okay, so it makes beautiful sense in how my personality structure lines up. Let me read to you from the article. The tertiary or child function is one that we often wield in a playful, exploratory, creative way. The tertiary function is often called the relief function by typologists, and that's because we can enjoy using it to relax, calm down, and take the pressure off of our often overused dominant or auxiliary functions. The child function is also how we like to be comforted many times, but not necessarily always. For example, if your tertiary function is extroverted feeling, FE, you may want to be comforted by receiving empathy, affirmation, and harmonious acceptance. If your tertiary function is introverted sensing, you might want to be comforted by receiving consistent practical dedication and by having reminders of ways you've succeeded in the past or good memories from the past. Here's a quote from Mark Hunziker. The eternal child tends to manifest in manic cycles. 1 minute, the king of the world, and the next, a withdrawn and timid, wounded child. Good integration of the child into the ego means allowing ourselves to be playful, silly, irresponsible, and vulnerable when appropriate and healthy. And I have to say, with TI or internal thinking being my tertiary, even though I excelled in grad school, you know, was invited into the PhD program, etc., you know, I got the work done, I didn't take it as seriously as other folks did. That is so true. Like, I immediately looked at the amount of reading and I'm like, yeah, that's not going to happen. and I didn't. But yeah, I kind of got the gist of it. And of course, I applied myself. Obviously, I didn't fake my way through. I was asked to continue by people who know what they're doing. But that said, I did maintain a playfulness about it. Like, I'm like, this is not going to like ruin my day. So there are better scholars in the world, let's just say that. But yet I got so much joy and enthusiasm, and relief is a great word, from diving into that material. It would calm me and I'd be like, oh, okay, I understand now. I understand. And so I did use and continue to use that function sort of in that way. Here's an important thing to remember. Often aren't aware when you're using the shadow functions or when you're projecting them onto other people. Okay, so it may take time and conscious awareness to see these archetypes in, you know, playing themselves out. And that's when, you know, we can be aware of, like I said, our past familiarization with like pendulums and feeling triggered and all of that. If that is happening, if those emotional hooks are happening, you're probably encountering something in the shadow, either in yourself or in the environment or in another person. Okay, so let's drop into the opposing role. Here is a quote from John Beebe. It is oppositional, paranoid, passive aggressive, and avoidant. This is a shadow that is very hard to see in oneself. It seems to fall in the blind spot of the superior function and very easy to project onto another person. Well, make no mistake, my husband and I lead with introverted intuition and he leads with extroverted intuition. He's an ENFP. So we have this opposing function in each other. And of course, that's the magic and that's the challenge at the same time. If you think of the dominant function as your hero, then you can imagine the opposing role as the snarky would-be usurper to the hero. The opposing role shadows your dominant function, calling out doubts, opposition, and passive-aggressive remarks. The opposing role may cause you to doubt your dominant function's goals or viewpoints. It also may be what you use when you become argumentative or lash out at someone or something that feels threatening to your ego. The opposing role is also extremely easy for us to project onto other people. Because our experience with that function is largely negative, when other people use that same function, even in a positive way, we can risk seeing them as being oppositional, passive aggressive, or having hidden motives. The second shadow function, which would be in the overall sixth position, is the critical parent or the witch cynics. Okay? And here's a great quote about that. Again, from Mark Hunziker, the witch cynics lacks the governing mechanism of consciousness to ensure that it's only used appropriately. Its criticisms are often withering and crippling. Okay, so we have to be really wise to the fact that that is nagging underneath consciousness. And to come to terms with the effect it may be having on us in terms of our ability to be confident. Okay. So this is an important function to become aware of. And again, it'll make sense as we move more into this series, which is why I'm doing it. I find it so interesting. But that's an important one to be aware of, that it sort of acts like a wicked step parent, if you will. Sometimes when we see someone being, in our view, childish, we take on this critical role. When someone is triggering our trickster function, which is the seventh function in our stack, which we'll get to here in a second, we might react by taking on our critical parent or witch to try to control them. Okay. It's amazing how all these layers sort of act out. And clearly, I can't emphasize this enough, your children, the people with whom you work, your partner, you're going to have mirrors of all of this in order to help you flesh out what is unconscious in you. Try to remember that. It helps depersonalize it. We're attracted to that which is other, and we can use that to fight and create more of it, or we can use that to learn and move into new relationship with those principles without like killing the person in the meantime. The shadow function number 7, the trickster. Here's a great quote from Jung. Although he is not really evil, the trickster does the most atrocious things from sheer unconsciousness and unrelatedness. And it often like turns things on its head to get our attention. The trickster shadows the tertiary eternal child function. In contrast to the innocent, vulnerable, and playful child, the trickster is sly, malicious, shape-shifting, and deceptive. He is both good and bad. He is determined to protect the eternal child from attacks from other people, but he can also create so much chaos in the process that conflict arises in relationship or the self. Using the trickster function feels uncomfortable, confusing, and disquieting. When using this function, we tend to trap people in double binds. We may find that we're disrespecting rules or boundaries or being manipulative in ways that don't feel right or relatable to us. The trickster sounds very negative, but is actually an important catalyst for growth and individuation. Here is Mark Hunziker again. The trickster is, above all, a catalyst for individuation. In this, the trickster is both destroyer and creator. It breaks down self-limiting structures, creating disorder in order to open up new options that lead to a new order. Wow. And you'll hear about my trickster in the weeks ahead. They're fun stories. Okay, and finally, the demon or the demonic function. This is so extraordinary. Again, not to be taken with anything but ultimate respect, but the demon feels the most other of the shadow functions. Our failures in this area can greatly undermine our lives. Ways that strike us as evil are generally those associated with negative traits from the demon. The demon is essentially our inferior's inferior function. Dang. It feels the most other. We may struggle with relating to people who use this function in the dominant position because our experiences with it are so negative and because we don't connect with it consciously except in very rare disquieting cases. We may project the demon onto other people who are using this function in an obvious way. It's important to recognize when you're projecting this function so you don't misunderstand or demonize others for using a function in a normal and healthy way. According to Beebe, the demon is what we need to be ashamed of, the flaw in our character for which integrity exists and is needed. So, this is a great way in to what we'll be exploring and diving into over the next 3 weeks. And well, I should say the next 3 sessions that will occupy the month of May. And I hope that this is insightful and helpful to you. Again, I will link this information if you want to read this article for yourself and sort of digest the material in the show notes. And enjoy the beautiful flower moon coming up here in about a week's time. And until next time, take good care. Hi, everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if my work is nourishing your heart and imagination, consider supporting the Apothecary Podcast. Just follow the links to make a contribution. And for the full scope of my projects and offerings, including my weekly newsletter, visit lorigreen.net.